The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're listening to Strange by Nature, your guide to the strange, weird, unbelievable, and improbable wonders of the natural world.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for being here today. I am Kirk Mona, and I am joined today by Rachel Ginza and Victoria Thompson. We are all professional naturalists who together have scoured the world for weird and wonderful wonders just to please your mammalian brain's desire for novelty. Isn't that nice? Let's do this.
All right. I'm going to get us started today. And I just want to apologize to you both. Because this is an animal that I discovered earlier today, and it was absolutely horrifying.
Oh, perfect.
I'm so excited.
Hold on. Rachel, you know what podcast you're on, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Why would you apologize for discovering something horrifying to share with us? That's why we're here.
Right, but normally Victoria is the one who brings the absolute nightmare fuel. I'm bringing a little bit more nightmare fuel to our podcast.
Oh, bless you.
Well, my topic this week is very gentle, so we balance each other out.
Oh, cool. There we go.
Mine is very calming as well, so we...
Oh, good. We'll start off on a horrifying, and then we go into calm. Awesome. So, in 2007... there was a German research vessel that was using an open net in the southern Atlantic Ocean, and they were trolling the Bethel Pelagic Zone, which was anywhere between 5,740 feet and all the way down to 6,560 feet deep into the ocean. Now, this is known as like the midnight zone of the ocean. Mm-hmm. It's not quite at the abyss. At the deep dark, there's no light. There's very, very little light that reaches the midnight zone.
Okay.
That's pretty deep.
Yeah.
It's pretty deep. Now, they bring the net up, and the researchers find one specimen of this never-seen-before sea creature.
Okay.
Now, I'm going to give you the Latin name of it. It wasn't until recently that it was given a more common name. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to have you both look at the picture that I emailed you. The Latin name for this species is Promocotyphus sulcus.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That doesn't sound too bad.
It doesn't
mean a lot to me, no.
There's about three species that have been discovered and studied a little bit. Remember, there's only been the one specimen found. Now, I want you to both open your emails and tell me what you see.
Okay.
All right.
Oh, no. No. No.
Oh, God.
God, that
the
is
teeth.
Just...
Oh. Okay, so I'm going to describe it here. So imagine...
Go for it.
Well, my first impression was a sea star with a lot of arms.
Yeah, like a 10-armed sea star, kind of, but there's like tentacles on the bottom.
There are tentacles. Mm-hmm. So the tentacle, it looks sort of like the suction cups on an octopus, but they're littler, maybe. It's a little hard to tell how big it is in this image.
But the middle.
In the middle. There's sort of, so there's an outer ring that's round, and then an inner area that's a little sort of depressed and white. And then in the middle.
Yeah, it's like a hexagon with like a pineapple circle in the middle.
There's the mouth of Sauron.
Oh.
That's a great description.
It's like a hell mouth. I mean, it looks like it's a round opening, but it looks like a full set of like dentures
it
have been popped in there.
Very scary human teeth.
Oh, yeah. Why does this exist, Rachel?
So this is
is there more to the creature? Or are we like just seeing sort of the bottom of it, I assume?
You're just seeing the bottom of it, yeah.
Okay.
That was the picture that I stumbled across and I went, there's no way this is real. Absolutely not. I triple quadruple checked. This is a real creature. That is a real picture from the research vessel. Okay.
Can I point something out interesting though? There's six arms across the top that have like the little suction cups on them, right?
Yeah.
And then there's two big beefy arms that come off the bottom, and then two more between those that have suction cups, but the two big beefy arms don't have any sort of like suction cups on them. What's up with that?
So that's what scientists are super interested in. Most common folk, when they see this is a commonly known as a gob-faced squid.
Sure it is.
Okay. I would call the hellmouth squid, but that works
right?
too.
Right, absolutely. So most scientists are not actually interested in what look like those teeth or dentures, which do look scarily like human teeth.
No, because if they thought about it too much, they'd never sleep.
Exactly. So those are actually not teeth. They are folded lips, which somehow makes it worse. So they are at the entrance of the mouth and they conceal the beak, which is a more traditional like squid beak.
Sure.
Okay?
Sure.
Yep.
And what happens, so they have that folded mouth, and that's what everybody else who sees a gob-faced squid freaks out about. What scientists are really interested in is that this species, like you were talking about, Kirk, they have eight arms, which are those smaller, thinner, tentacle-like appendages, and they're thinner at the base with a lot of
like an octopus.
Gotcha. But those are arms, they're not tentacles. Okay, there is a difference.
You mean the two extra things or the eight things?
The eight things. Those are eight arms.
Okay, so they're not tentacles. Okay.
They are not. And generally they have sucker, so arms are defined in squids and octopus that arms have suckers that are along most of the length of that arm. Tentacles only have suckers near the ends, which generally develops like a club.
Okay.
Gotcha.
So
yeah,
really thick, I'm using my own shoulder, like that makes sense. Those two really thick tentacles is abnormal because generally arms and tentacles in squid and other species, they're uniform looking. You can't tell the difference for the most part.
So the two bigger ones, they actually are tentacles?
Those are actually tentacles.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So they have
a club at the end of the tentacle.
It's been like pumping
that
iron
has suckers
with its two tentacles, basically, to beef them up.
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. So because it is, not only are the arms and the tentacles different widths at the base, but the scientists are really interested in the fact that it's actually irregular proportion from their body to the tentacles. Usually there's an equal or there's a general proportion that scientists have seen in squid, especially when it comes to the length of their body and the length of their tentacles, and this is very irregular.
So is this actually technically classified as a type of squid, or is it just in its own
group? This particular, I think I said it earlier, there's only about three species in this genus. So it is kind of in its own, and they all are generally known for having those suckers being like the suckers on the arms are much larger than the club suckers on the tentacles, and the head and the mantle of that squid is actually fused rather than separate parts.
Okay, so it is a type of squid, but it's just in its own
yes,
genus.
Exactly. Okay. The other really interesting thing, so it looks horrifying, right? Like you wouldn't want to run into this along the bottom of the ocean, right?
No. And you know what, it's come to me what else this reminds me of? If any of you have seen Pan's Labyrinth, the Pale Man, it's this monster with no eyes and really big teeth in its mouth. So, yeah.
Oh, good.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds horrifying. This squid is only about an inch long.
What? Oh. Wait, hold on. Okay, you tricked us.
Is it in a petri dish? In this picture?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so from this picture, I'm picturing something that's like coming through, the forest in the Upside Down after me or something. This is tiny. It's
tiny. It's only about an inch long. Scientists don't think they get that much bigger.
Okay, is the fact that it could accidentally crawl into your mouth, does that make it creepier?
Now that you've said it out loud, yes.
Well, now I won't sleep.
But it can't eat you, though, is the point.
No, it absolutely can't. Not a lot is known about this particular species of squid. There's only been the one specimen found in 2007. So that's fairly recent as well.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's what I have for you today.
That was really special. Thank you.
That is special. And again, we're going to have to get a picture of this up if we can for everyone to see, because... Oh, it's just when you see something like this, you gotta share it. It's like a earworm. You gotta share it in order to get it out of your brain. This is
absolutely
wow.
You're welcome.
Hey everyone, we've been asking folks if they like the show to leave 5-star ratings on their podcast app of choice. So I'm going to read one here from Apple Podcasts that Katie Duke 05 left the other day. So this says, I listened to the first 6 episodes in one day. This podcast provides all kinds of fun examples of how huge, complex, and amazing the natural world is. But it's also a very human show, full of humor and glimpses into how the economy and human health intertwine with nature, as well as into the careers of naturalists. What an awesome review. Thanks, Katie Duke. And If you folks are enjoying the podcast, we would really appreciate it if you would leave your own 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. It would really help us out and help other people find the show. Thanks. All right, we're back from the break, and my story starts out as a story about geology, but it's going to turn into something else. So I'm going to take you back to 1977, and at that time, plate tectonics had only really been widely accepted as a theory in geology for about 10 to 15 years. So this is the theory that really revolutionized geology.
Alfred Wegener.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not going to go there.
Alfred Wegener, man.
Very cool story. But I'm going to kind of skate pretty quickly through that part. So just as a reminder, plate tectonics is the theory that revolutionized geology. So instead of thinking that the continents were fixed in place, they realized that continents are attached to giant plates that move around and are pushed apart at ridges and then disappear in subduction zones. So if you've heard of the Ring of Fire, it's related to that. Most earthquakes and volcanoes occur related to plate tectonics and plate boundaries.
Not the Johnny Cash song.
No, that is different.
Okay.
So in 1977, geologists were still in the process of learning about the way plate tectonics worked and kind of proving some of the different parts of it. And one of the things that was expected to occur but had not yet been found was hydrothermal vents in areas where plates were spreading apart. So this is where magma is coming up as the Earth is spreading apart at a plate boundary. And cracks are going to occur, and the seawater is going to get down in there and become superheated by the magma. and then come up sort of like an underwater geyser or a hot spring. So they really wanted to find these, and so they created Alvin, which was the first submersible that was capable of carrying people down to deep areas of the ocean floor. And in 1974, they did an expedition in Alvin to the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, which is a major spreading zone. And the occupants were able to get down there and observe the rift zone where the magma was coming up. Super cool. But they did not find any hydrothermal vents. So they started very disappointing. So they started looking for other spots, and they found some good evidence of them near the Galapagos Rift, which is west of Ecuador, near the Galapagos Islands, go figure. So in 1977, a team headed to the Galapagos, and this, by the way, included Robert Ballard, who later became famous for discovering the wreck of the Titanic. So they were there in a ship. They had Alvin ready to go and to scope exactly where they wanted to pinpoint Alvin to. They sent some deep sea cameras to scope the area first, and they found an area with a temperature spike. But as they started to develop the photos, they realized that in some of these photos, there were heaps of clams and mussels right where this temperature spike was. And this was really confusing to them because the ocean floor was supposed to be a barren desert. Nothing was supposed to really live there. So they see this and they're like, huh? Anyway, barely hours after the photos were developed, the team gets into Alvin, descends to the seafloor at this site where the temperature spike had been found. And so I'm going to quote Robert Ballard here briefly from one of his later books. So he said, quote, "Alvin and its three-man crew entered another world. Coming out of small cracks cutting across the lava terrain was warm, shimmering water," unquote. And even crazier, surrounding these vent sites where the warm water was coming out was a huge spread of different kinds of animals. There were clams, there were mussels, there were crabs, there were octopus, there were several foot long white tube worms with red tops that were all clustered together like a field of flowers kind of blowing around in the current like flowers in the wind. And the scientists were looking at this, and it was like a geologist and a physicist and a geochemist. They hadn't thought to bring a biologist on the expedition. Not just in Alvin, but not on the ship.
Not, yeah.
There was no...
Why would they do
they
that?
They didn't think they needed to.
Why would you bring a biologist to the Galapagos Islands? I mean, that's
so
crazy.
This is the abyssal zone, like Rachel was mentioning earlier. There is no light down there. The temperature is barely above freezing once you're away from the vents. And so since all of life as they knew it then was based on photosynthesis, they were completely they just didn't know how these animals could be surviving and thriving where they were. So just as a review, like photosynthesis is where plants or algae can use the energy from sunlight to crack open carbon dioxide, and then they use that carbon to build their cells. And that's the basis for the entire food web and all life on Earth as it was known then. And obviously there couldn't be any photosynthesis going on down there because there was no light. And because they hadn't expected to find the stuff, the ship didn't even have stuff to preserve all the specimens that they collected. They had a small amount of formaldehyde that one student had brought, and they resorted to using some vodka that they had bought in Panama.
Of course. Hey, sounds like a research trip.
Yeah. But they did eventually get these specimens back to some biologists and did some other expeditions a couple years later. And the biologists eventually figured out that there were bacteria at these vents, and these vents were spewing out something called hydrogen sulfide, which is a chemical. And instead of sunlight, the bacteria use the energy from the chemical oxidation of hydrogen sulfide to crack the CO2 to get the carbon. So this is called chemosynthesis instead of photosynthesis. And this is it's amazing. This is the basis of the entire food chain down there. The other organisms eat the bacteria, and then so on and so forth. And they're actually like those tube worms with the white tubes and the red tops. They have a symbiotic relationship with the bacteria. So the bacteria are actually inside their bodies creating this energy for them.
Really?
Yeah.
That's
so this entire ecosystem exists without the sun, living on energy from the depths of the planet. And this discovery was something that just completely revolutionized the understanding of how life on this planet can be. And in fact, it kind of opened up what our possibilities are for finding extraterrestrial life, because it expanded outside of those very narrow boundaries what the ingredients are for sustaining life. So really one of the all-time greatest discoveries.
So cool.
It's not great for a podcast, but I'm speechless. Yeah, like I had heard of life at the hydrothermic vents before, but it never, like, I never thought about how revolutionary that actually is.
Well, I know they are working on, you know, there are people who want to send spacecraft to some of the moons and places in our solar system to look for other forms of life. And some of this was the inspiration for that, to think about what are some of the ways you would detect life that functions in a different way than life does on Earth. So, I mean, it's so cool.
Yeah. Well, and after the break, we'll have Kirk.
Victoria, what do you think dental floss is made out of?
Isn't it just like a long string of plastic, basically?
Yeah, it's made out of PTFE, which is the generic name for Teflon. You're right, it's just a big long piece of plastic. Look, flossing is important to the health of your teeth, but when you throw that floss out each day, you're basically creating waste that will last for thousands of years. It's nuts! Our friends at Ecocasion.com once again have a solution, and it's dental lace. This all-natural product comes in a beautiful glass vial with a cool metal lid. It comes in a natural silk or a plant-based alternative for our vegan listeners. Dental lace is just one of hundreds of products curated to make your life more ecologically friendly. And you can find them all over at Ecocasion.com. That's Ecocasion.com. Use code STRANGE at checkout to apply our special discount to your entire order. All right. I want you to imagine being out in the wild. There are predatory animals that want very badly to make you their prey. You basically spend your life surrounded by your enemies, and you're trying your hardest to survive when suddenly you lose consciousness.
That sounds terrible.
Bad idea.
What? Yeah, horrible idea, right? I mean, it sounds like a nightmare scenario. Being unconscious is pretty much the worst possible thing for you.
Falling, especially if you're surrounded by predators.
Right. I don't mean surrounded in a circle. I mean that they're out there at all times in the habitat with you. So falling unconscious is pretty much the most vulnerable state for an animal to be in that you can possibly imagine. And this sounds bad, yet it happens every single day. And we don't call it falling unconscious. We call it falling asleep. So
Kirk,
sleep,
where are you going with this?
Sleep is a state where we lose consciousness, right? Now, oh man, we could do an entire podcast series just devoted to the scientific and philosophical question of what is consciousness. So to be clear, I'm going with a relatively simple definition here of consciousness as being aware of and responsive to your surroundings. Right. I'm leaving out the larger question of awareness of self and all that, which is a larger topic. So armed with this simple definition, we can see that when we are asleep, we have lost our awareness of our surroundings. We essentially are unconscious. And it's really quite shocking to think that this even occurs in animals, you know, given how vulnerable it makes them. And let's be clear, it also, you know, makes us, because we are animals as well. And we have this habit of falling unconscious every single night. So let's talk about people for a minute. There are 7.8 billion humans on Earth right now, generally supposed to get about 8 hours of sleep. One third of our day, 8 hours is one third of our day, right? So for one third of our day, you know, people are sleeping. At any given moment, there's about 2.5 billion unconscious humans collapsed across the surface of the Earth.
Huh.
Which is not how we're used to thinking about it. But I mean, really, it's
not
like
at all.
2.5 billion unconscious humans right now. And of course, the human population is not, evenly distributed across the face of the Earth. So it's going to vary. Sometimes it's going to be less than that. Sometimes there's going to be quite a bit more of that, depending on where it is.
Well, and also, you know, some of those humans are babies, and babies sleep a lot more than 8 hours a day.
There you go. That's true. That's very true. Which, again, if you're a baby and you're already really vulnerable, adding unconsciousness into that mix is not particularly helpful, right? Although it is really nice when you're a new parent and you're like, oh, thank God they've gone unconscious. Let's be clear, unexpected unconsciousness in your baby is a 911 call, but expected consciousness is a wonderful, beautiful, glorious moment.
What a way to phrase that.
Let's keep in mind that that's just humans. There's also rhinos and sheep and cows and birds and insects and an amazing variety of animal life on Earth. And this same pattern holds true for all of them. The sun goes down and they lapse into a vulnerable, unconscious state. Now, it's true. Not all animals do at night. I'm talking about what we call diurnal animals. So that means those that are awake during the day. We also have nocturnal animals that have flipped the pattern and they're awake at night. And there's even those that really mess with the timing of sleep and are most active at dawn and dusk and kind of sleep on and off at other times. And we call those animals crepuscular. If you have a cat, it's a great example of a crepuscular animal that we're familiar with. But
I can vouch for that.
Yeah. Regardless of when they sleep, all these animals do need sleep. At some point, they all fall unconscious and enter this incredibly vulnerable state. And evolution can be thought of as a process of weeding out those things that make a species less likely to succeed. So from that perspective, it seems pretty shocking that sleep exists at all. Falling unconscious for one third of every 24-hour period is not only incredibly inefficient, it's also dangerous. So what this tells us is that sleep must be incredibly important if there's no way to avoid it. Animals must sleep. Even animals that hibernate, we have learned animals that hibernate actually come out of hibernation in the middle of the winter so they can sleep and then go back into hibernation.
Wait,
oh, yeah. Yeah. Animals that hibernate will actually, now they're not going to look any different to someone who is to observe them, because they sleep and hibernation look kind of similar. But if you monitor their brain activity, hibernating animals will actually come out of hibernation, go to sleep, and then go back into hibernation, which gives you an idea of how incredibly important sleep really is. Now, we don't yet...
Especially with how many animals sleep. I think every single animal sleeps. So how far back in the evolutionary history must sleep have developed?
Oh, it's it seems to be a very core fundamental thing that must go back incredibly far. So if we think that we don't understand everything about sleep yet, it's a really great place where research is being done. But one of the things we are coming to understand more and more is that sleep is when the brain goes into repair mode. And if we don't sleep, the brain eventually cannot continue to function correctly. Now, nature loves to come up with solutions to problems through evolution. And falling unconscious is definitely a problem that you'd think needs to be overcome. So my favorite solution is something called unihemispheric slow wave
sleep. Oh, I know what this is.
So slow wave sleep.
I have no idea.
Perfect. Slow wave sleep is what might commonly be called deep sleep or rapid eye movement sleep or REM sleep.
Okay.
This is like that deepest state of sleep. And it's very important to animals. Unihemispheric slow wave sleep means half of your brain goes to sleep at a time. So uni meaning one and hemispheric, so you know, half of your brain. So one half of the brain is sleeping at a time. This has been observed in setons like dolphins, whales, and orcas, also in birds. One really weird quirk about unihemispheric slow wave sleep is that animals that do it sometimes literally sleep with one eye open.
I don't like that.
Yeah, so there's that old phrase about sleeping with one eye open. Well, there are animals that do that because, you know, the half of their brain that is sleeping, that eye that corresponds with that half of their body goes to sleep. Or actually, usually it's crossed. It's the opposite eye, the one that's going to go to sleep. And the other eye is awake and alert. And that half of the brain is monitoring for predators and whatnot. And they'll take turns on which half of their brain is sleeping at once, which is just
I would not awesome. Want to come across an orca who is half of its brain is asleep. That sounds like a terrible idea.
Well, it's probably going to be not as alert as it would be when its whole brain is active. So they definitely are a little bit more like chilled out at this time, but they can still be more aware of their surroundings. So it's a compromise. It's not like they're just tootling about their normal activity, like feeding and things like that. It's just a more of a way to be aware of your surroundings and, you know, keep on swimming, keep on coming up for air. If you're an orca, you're an air breather. So if you were to sleep and, you know, fall down to the bottom, you're going to drown. So you need to have a way to be keeping going to the surface and getting air. So it's useful for that. Mallard ducks actually do this. If you ever see a big raft of mallards that are sleeping, you can actually, really cool, by looking at them, tell which half of their brain is asleep. And the way you would do this is by looking, you know, if you have ducks that are all around the outside of the circle, the eye that is facing the outside looking for predators, that's the awake, you know, half. And then the half that's facing on the inside that has the closed eye, again, the eyes, it's switched. So actually the outside half is the half of the brain that's asleep and awake. But, you know,
right.
It's you can basically, they keep the awake side of their body that's looking out for, or the awake eye facing to the outside looking for predators. And on the inside, they don't care what, you know, like, you know, Hubert or whatever his name is next to them is doing because he's sleeping. So they have that closed eye toward the inside. So that is super cool. Now, the weird thing is it's the opposite for animals like dolphins and killer whales and whatnot. They're at the top of the food chain. So they're not really concerned about predators coming in. They actually have the outside eye, you know, either closed or not, you know, seeing predators. And the half that's facing the inside of the pod, that is what is awake, because pod cohesion and keeping with your family group is what's important. So that's the half of the brain that is awake in animals like that. Super, super cool. The other animal that they've shown to do this is birds, especially those that are long distance migrators that are out over the ocean, and they'll keep on flying while they shut down one half of their brain. And the fact that both wings can keep on flapping and keep them flying is pretty cool, or at least soaring if they're soaring on wind currents and whatnot. But they can keep on flying and stay aloft while one half of their brain sleeps, which again is a great adaptation that has allowed them to move into a habitat where you couldn't live out over the open ocean if you were going to fall asleep and plummet into the water. There are even birds, a really common bird. You might probably the number one common bird you're going to see around your house, especially if you live in a more urban area. Here in the United States is going to be a house sparrow, an English house sparrow. They also do this where you'll sometimes see them with one eye closed. They are doing unihemispheric sleeping. It's not something that birds will do or all animals will do all the time. Some of it relates to how dangerous a situation is. Like if they are on an incredibly safe spot, they're like, okay, I can fully go to sleep here. But if it's kind of a sketchy area, you're like, I don't want to let my guard down. They can just shut down one half of their brain at a time. So super, super cool thing that animals can do. As you can imagine, being half awake is an enormous evolutionary advantage and gives you, you know, advantages. So while we can't eliminate sleep, some species have evolved some pretty amazing workarounds.
That's super cool.
That's so fascinating.
Also, all this talk about sleep is starting to make me sleepy.
I know. I was holding back some yawns just because we were talking about sleep so much.
Well, I hope, you know, you can close both eyes and get your regular slow wave sleep tonight.
Right. Unless, you know, I look at the picture of the gob-faced squid again.
Don't do that.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to today's show. Be sure to subscribe. New episodes drop every Wednesday, and we love sharing this strange world with all of our listeners. If you would be so kind as to leave us a 5-star review, that would be great. It lets other lovers of the strange discover the show. You can reach out to us on social media by searching for Strange by Nature Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can send us an email as well. Our address is contact@strangebynaturepodcast.com. If you want more information about the show, you can also check out our website, which is strangebynaturepodcast.com. Until next week, get outside, stay curious, and embrace the strange.
Okay, so Promocotethus succulus. Sulcus. God. I even wrote it in... We're going to have to edit all this out. I wrote it phonetically.
That's fine. Give it one more time.
I've practiced this for 10 minutes.
This would be a great blooper reel.
So good.
I am okay. Saving all of this.
Keep going, Rachel. You'll get it eventually. Okay.
You'll get it.
It's Promocotiphus sulcus.